I'd like to talk tonight about the beauty of beginning again and how with practice we can do this in each and every moment, begin again. And I'm just curious, how many of you in here made New Year's resolutions in January? I saw one hand. Nobody makes resolutions anymore? I know I did. So how many of you who made them have broken them already? Yes, me. So for most of us, there tends to be this really distressing, if not just depressing, discrepancy between our real and genuine good intentions and how we actually act when we're faced with the reality of being human. So Pema Chodron, one of my favorite Buddhist nuns, tells a story I love about this. She writes, "One afternoon I was riding a bus in San Francisco, reading a very touching article on human suffering and helping others. The idea of being generous and extending myself to those in need became so poignant that I started to cry. People were looking at me as the tears ran down my cheeks. I felt a great tenderness toward everyone, and a commitment to benefit others arose in me. As soon as I got home, feeling pretty exhausted after working all day, the phone rang, and it was someone asking if I could please help her out by taking her position as a meditation leader later that night. I said, 'No, sorry, I need to rest,' and hung up." I love that story. So, especially when we've been practicing meditation, there can be this really confusing tension between how we envision our meditation practice, ourselves, and our lives, and the actual reality of our lives and of being completely human. So, like, for instance, you might consider what happens when you're tired, or you're hungry, or you're in pain, or you're stressed out, or you're afraid, or bored, or angry, right? Whatever you're experiencing. So often, if you think about it, we end up feeling like we've somehow failed, don't we? When we're in those states as a meditator, I know I do. Like, wait a minute, I'm angry. How is that, you know, as a meditation teacher? And what happens is that when we feel like we've failed in some way, we turn that into a sense of self that has failed, and we take it on as our identity. And then we carry that identity around with us in both big and small ways. So I like this cartoon I saw floating around on Facebook a few weeks ago, and it said, "I can't believe it's been a whole year since I didn't become a better person." And yet, don't we wake up with the same assessment sometimes? It's like, I can't believe I'm not a better person since yesterday. Right? In fact, aren't we always in some ways constantly making this assessment? Think about it. How often do you ask yourself, subconsciously or even consciously, how am I doing? How am I doing? How am I doing? Isn't it kind of constant a lot of the time? Be really honest with ourselves? And yet, whenever we're making these assessments or judgments, you might notice you're also, at the same time, making some resolution to do something different. We're judging ourselves, and then, oh, I gotta do that differently. Which is great. We all want more happiness in our lives. That's kind of what we're trying to do here. Discover what's, you know, causing the suffering, and how can I create more happiness? What can I do to lead for more happiness in myself? The problem is we don't often give ourselves permission to fail at this process in any way, to let our meditation, and especially our lives, be a practice. So, you know, we don't allow ourselves to be perfectly human, which, as most of you know, is a major setup for suffering. In fact, so many of us don't give ourselves a break for failing at anything, do we? It's like we're supposed to be perfect at everything all the time. I know that I have that gene, that perfection. Anybody else have that perfectionist thing going on? Yes, okay. And we rarely give ourselves a break or forgive ourselves, and sometimes we can get super grim about it. The poet Donna Faulds, who I love, has a beautiful line in one of her poems that I like to reflect on, which is simply, "Perfection is not a prerequisite for anything but pain." Isn't that true? Perfection is not a prerequisite for anything but pain. We also, I think, tend to feel like it's only us that have failed, it's only me that has failed, and everybody else seems to know what they're doing. Like, everybody else got that instruction manual somewhere. It's a secret instruction manual, but I must have been absent that day. Everybody else has that. I love the way Thomas Edison conceptualized the word failure. When a reporter asked him how he felt about failing 2,000 times before he invented the light bulb, he responded, "My dear young man, I did not fail. I did invent the light bulb. It was simply a 2,000-step process." Last year, anybody know the author Jenny Lawson? She has a new book out called Furiously Happy, a funny thing about book about horrible things. It's really funny. And she tweeted a really embarrassing exchange she had with a cashier at an airport. And it just read, "Airport cashier, have a safe flight. Me, you too." And then in all bold, "I can never come here again." After she shared that, all these people started sharing their own embarrassing moments, and I'm going to share a few with you tonight. One of his, I texted my boss at the end of the first day in the new job with, "Heading out, love you," intended for my boyfriend. Bought Preparation H for under eye bags, told the clerk she didn't need to bag it because I was going to use it in the car. Ended a supposedly professional work email to Alcoholics Anonymous with, "Cheers, Sarah." So we can laugh about this, but if, you know, you might think about just maybe small things like this. These are just funny human errors, aren't they? Things you've done or said in the past, but consider some of these things, how long you hold on to them. Just consider it. You know, is that easy to let go? Sometimes we hold on to the tiniest things, don't we? And then we use it as ammunition against ourselves. It's like, you know, let me pull out my arsenal of things that I have to beat myself up about. It's helpful to remember that whenever we get hooked on to some sense of failure, in both small and much larger levels, it is our habitual reaction to want to run away, fight back, or maybe even just completely numb it out. Okay? Sometimes this running or fighting means that we want to jump right in and assess blame, don't we? It's our fault, it's someone else's fault, we blame the situation. Sometimes I think, don't we even blame the rain for raining? Right? It's like these, who's responsible for this rain? What we absolutely don't want to do is to stay in that uncomfortable place where we feel raw and vulnerable, maybe even kind of shaky. And for me, sometimes it can just feel like, you know, I've been stranded somewhere in the dark, alone, in the cold, the wind, and the rain. Doesn't it feel like that? You're very lonely when you're in that place. It's scary, doesn't it? It's just really uncomfortable. And it can feel awful. And most of what we want desperately is to find warmth and shelter and safety right now. Not in a little while, right now. And we have little tolerance for just being there with it, being with the uncomfortableness, the shakiness, the uncomfortableness. And being there really means being alone with ourselves and all the wonderful content of our minds and whatever's happening inside the body. Remembering that it is never about the situations we find ourselves in, but the thoughts around it. This is such a hard one to get, because I always forget about that a lot of the times. I think it's about the situation or the person or me, and it's always about how I'm relating or responding to it. It doesn't really have anything to do with the situation. And it's often an incredibly uncomfortable and embarrassing state. It's the place where we want to give up. We tend to want to give up on ourselves or others or even the whole situation. I just give up. And we also tend to somehow automatically believe our thinking around this, our thoughts. and agree in our minds that yes, we failed, either consciously or unconsciously. And when we do this, that feeling of failure can get stuck, and it can sometimes live in our bodies for years and decades, doesn't it? In the body and mind and heart. Can you even think of something right now, maybe 10 years ago, 20 years ago, that's just still stuck there, that you feel like you haven't let yourself off the hook for? There's some sense of failure in that, and there was some sense of giving up, like that thing will never change, right? So when this happens, it not only lives there, but we tend to unearth it. We dig it up again and again, and again use it as ammunition against ourselves. Or we solidify our sense of identity as a person who has failed at this particular thing, and that becomes part of our identity rather than a fluid thing. Happily, that's the problem. Happily, the practice teaches us that this place of uncomfortableness, that place of standing out in the cold and rain and wind, if you will, of the mind, is the very point in our meditation and in our lives when we can really learn something and transform. That's it. And that is where the beauty of beginning again starts. That's where it starts. Because when we can stand in it, absolutely, that's where something new can emerge. Okay? That's the place. So, just as a reminder again, it's really helpful and important to remember that it is our very human tendency to want to run away from discomfort, to seek solid ground. We all want to remain in that friendly, warm, happy territory. I like the way Marilyn Ferguson describes this. She says, "It's not so much that we're afraid of change or so in love with the old ways, but it's that place in between that we fear. It's like being between trapezes. It's Linus when his blanket is in the dryer. There's nothing to hold on to." And again, it's really okay. That's our human tendency to want that. We want that blanket. We want that ground under our feet. We want security. We want certainty. We want to lock everything down. So we don't need to give ourselves an even harder time when we see that we want this. It's completely normal. It's okay. The more you continue to practice, the more you're going to recognize that that feeling of having the rug pulled out from under you, having no ground to stand on, again, is actually where the practice truly begins. And eventually, over the years, many of you maybe do this already, you learn to bow to it. You know, when there's that uncomfortableness, that pain, that suffering, you kind of bow in and you say, thank you. Because this is where I can, this is a chance for me to transform. This is where it starts. A lot of people come to this practice of meditation, and maybe some of you have, to get a sense of peace. My life is chaotic. It's crazy. I want some peace. Of course we do. We all want that. It's the shamatha calming part of the practice, and it absolutely provides that. And you might have gotten a little taste of that even during our meditation practice here. Tonight, that calming practice. But if we're just stuck in the calming practice, and if that's all we're looking for, that nice, happy feeling, we're not going to have true and lasting peace, because we need to look into the nature of our mind, and sometimes looking at the nature of our mind, as you all know, is incredibly difficult and is suffering. Sometimes it's hard. But the way out is through, is what I always say. You have to go through it to come out on the other side. So what this means to me a lot of times is that we have to be willing to expose ourselves, if you will, excuse the metaphor, be naked with ourselves in some way, which can be terrifying, right? So imagine right now if I, you know, ask you all to just take your clothes off. Wouldn't that be kind of terrifying? Okay, we're going to do this now, right? We're going to just strip and get naked. We're just going to be with it. So I have to share, in my early 20s, I was at studying writing and meditation in this notoriously radically liberal Shambhala Buddhist University in Colorado called Naropa University. Anybody know Naropa? Anybody go there? Alumni? So there was this protest about a play or something, I don't know. And we were protesting because it was going to involve some nudity, and Naropa shut it down, and we were just horrified that, you know, Naropa would not allow this nudity. So about 20 of us agreed to protest by gathering near the theater and stripping. And I have to tell you, I was one of the organizers. I was really up in arms about, like, how can they be so crude and yada yada. And when it came time, the day to actually strip, I showed up late. And I sat in a circle with all my clothes on, and I couldn't take them off. I was terrified. And everybody else was naked. And I was in my 20s, so I looked much better than now. It was probably easier. But, you know, this feeling of being, because I was one of the organizers, I was like, yes, I felt so embarrassed about that. And this sense of failure just kind of stuck in my mind, and I put it away somewhere. And yet I always think about this instance of as a way of being kind to myself and others when it comes to allowing ourselves to be seen. And that's a really big metaphor there. But there's so many other ways that we don't allow ourselves to be seen because it's so hard. It takes so much courage. And this includes allowing yourself to be seen by yourself. We hide ourselves from ourselves. Takes so much courage. And that's what the practice is about. It's about sitting with yourself and being able to have the courage to look at your own mind. When I was a little older, in my early 30s, I was celebrating a year of sobriety, and a friend of mine convinced me to join her in this naked polar bear swim, which meant stripping all my clothes off and diving into the ocean, the freezing ocean, with about 50 other people. And I did it. I was so proud of myself. I finally got over that. But when we can allow ourselves to be exposed in this way, if you will, there's always almost inevitably a doorway that opens into this place of greater expansion. And so I want to encourage you all not to strip, but be naked to, allow yourself to be naked to yourself. You know, if you can use that metaphor in any way. So rather than contracting and hiding and covering over, whenever we can let go and allow ourselves to be exposed, there's such a freedom in it. It can be difficult, but it's such a freedom. You know, it's really a metaphor for coming out of your shell, if you will. Exposing yourself to all the elements, which is so terrifying, but it's so freeing. Also through the practice, we learn over and over again and more each time we practice that we can really stay with the shakiness and the tenderness and the rawness of the physical sensations of grief and anger and shame. We can learn to stay with the body through meditation practice and allow these emotions, shame, grief, anger, envy, all of it to flow through, knowing more and more that these are just simply physical sensations. They are not us. They don't define us. They're physical sensations that change and move and flow through if we don't get stuck in them. We also, more and more through the practice, recognize that we can handle them. We don't have to suppress them or smush them down, which of course makes them worse, right? We learn it's just a physical sensation. I can handle this, and I don't have to identify it. I don't have to make that me. We can also allow ourselves to take a good look at our thoughts and our beliefs in practice and ask ourselves, what am I saying to myself? What am I believing about this situation or about myself? And then practice not making any of those things wrong, especially yourself. you know, we tend to get this identity that's hooked on to some physical sensation like anger, and we think instead of anger going through me, we hook onto it as I'm an angry person, or I'm feeling shame, so I'm a shameful person. We hook onto an identity of it. It's just a physical sensation. It's also about allowing yourself to be seen for everything that you are, all your, you know, wrinkles and warts and chubbiness, if that's what it is, all of it. What we're doing when we're practicing exposing ourselves to whatever we're feeling and experiencing is learning that we are human. We are imperfect, and it's completely okay. This is how we learn. This is how we begin again and again and again, and how we begin to love ourselves completely for being completely human. It's also how we learn to feel connected to everyone, since we really begin to see that none of us is perfect. Not a single one of us. Mother Teresa once famously said this to her community of nuns. Mother Teresa, keep in mind that our community is not composed of those who are already saints, but of those who are trying to become saints. Therefore, let us be extremely patient with each other's faults and failures. And I want you to notice that she said we, and included herself in this. So I feel like, you know, if Mother Teresa can be kind to her faults and failures, I can work on being kind to mine as well. The teachings also tell us that we don't learn by avoiding ourselves, our lives, other people, all the situations that we find ourselves in. We learn that we can really completely blow it, and it's okay. We can begin again. For instance, we won't learn a lot by sitting in a circle with our clothes on, right? Or standing by the sidelines with our clothes on or watching the show. Though sometimes learning means that we start by simply showing up, by sitting in that circle, even if we still can't take our clothes off. That's where it starts. Again, years later, I recognized that that was the first step. It took so much courage just to show up and sit there, even though I didn't take my clothes off. I could have just blown it off completely. So I realized that there was a little bit of courage in there. And I want you to, or suggest that maybe you look at all the ways that you think that you've blown it, but there was actually a bit of courage in what you did. It also helps me to remember that we're not even going to do this practice perfectly. We're going to hang up on another meditation teacher when they call us to sub for them. We're also going to lose touch with our breath, and we're going to daydream during practice. We're going to feel irritated and angry and envious and shameful when we're expecting ourselves to feel blissful and just completely blissed out and heavenly. And there's also times when we're going to want to and be totally unable to expose ourselves to ourselves. We're going to want to get naked with ourselves, want to be intimate with our minds, and we're not going to be able to do it. Whenever we feel that we have in some way failed, instead of beating ourselves up and getting very grim about it, what we can do is learn to lighten up a bit about it. And the best way I know to do this, to lighten up, is with loving kindness metta practice. This is on the back of my car, if anybody notices the metta, little blue car on there. I have metta on my license plate because I need to remind myself over and over and over every day, every moment. The practice begins and ends with kindness, loving kindness. Offering metta to yourself first, as always, is a way to help you recognize, again, that you're totally human and that you're new at this. Have you ever been this age before? Right? We're all new at this. One of my dear teachers, Tara Brach, who you all probably know, so often says, we're not to blame. And I used to get really upset when she used to say, what do you mean we're not to blame? What are you talking about? I didn't understand that concept. And what it means is that, you know, we're all a product of what are called the causes and conditions. We all were brought up with particular families, in a particular culture. We all had a set and variety of different experiences in our lives, accidents, everything that affected us. And these have created habitual and almost expected ways of reacting. You might think about anybody in your life and look at their lives and look at their upbringing and look at everything they've gone through in their lives and the way they react. And you can almost say you expect it, don't you? It's like if you look really look back at it and say, okay, that makes sense. And the same thing goes with us. And so we're really not to blame for our conditioning. The only thing we have control of is this moment and how we're reacting and responding to that conditioning. But we're not really to blame for so much of our conditioning. So whenever we find ourselves acting out on our conditioning, we can practice remembering that we're simply acting out on old causes and conditions, old beliefs, which are, by the way, most likely untrue, and give ourselves a break in compassion and kindness. So just as a for instance, when my, I think I've shared this story in here before, but when my niece was a little girl, very young, she was playing with my parents' new Cocker Spaniel, and very hyper Cocker Spaniel, very hyper little girl, and what happened is the Cocker Spaniel ended up biting her pretty deeply in the face. Had to bring her to the hospital. It was pretty traumatic. And today, as an adult, she's extremely terrified of dogs. Terrified, even a little puppy. She says, you know, get it away from me. It's a, you know, dog. And she won't go near this, near them, and she feels terrible about this, that she's so terrified of dogs. She feels like kind of a failure, like, what's wrong with me? Because intellectually, she knows, right? But do you blame her? Anybody here blame her for that? So it's the same, that's the idea. It's like the same way with us. It's like we blame ourselves for our conditioning instead of bringing kindness so often. And we think it's an inherent part of us that we've failed in some way. We also then, because of our conditioning, automatically, we tend to automatically accept our beliefs and thoughts as true, and we don't question them. We don't often question our beliefs. We just buy into them. So through our practice, as we allow our thoughts to be exposed to us, become aware of our own conditioning, and at the same time give ourselves a very big break for how we respond to this conditioning, that's where the transformation can come. Forgiveness practice, then, is such an important part of beginning again. It's so crucial. So through our practice, we can learn to offer this to ourselves again and again and again and start over in each moment. So for instance, in my niece's case, you know, she probably isn't going to give up her belief automatically and jump right in and start playing with Cocker Spaniels. That's not how we do it. But, you know, she might start with forgiving herself for her conditioning and allow herself to feel the pain of holding that belief for so many years. That's where she could start. So that once she gives herself kindness over and over for having this belief and this conditioning, that's when it can start to loosen and she can release it. Then she might begin by allowing herself to play with a puppy who might be, you know, hand-sized maybe, so that the fear is manageable. And we can all do that ourselves. We can start small, you know. We could take off a necklace. Using that metaphor a little bit too much. Take off a shoe. So, you know, even in the most intimate part of practice, staying present, following the breath, we are going to fail at this again and again and again, which is why I love it. It's not called a perfection. It's called a practice. It's a practice. And remember this with our lives as well. So, for instance, we might notice when we've moved away from the breath and away from presence, instead of beating ourselves up about this, we can actually celebrate this, that moment. So what happens, you know, think about it. What happens when you move away from the breath in meditation practice? Just be honest with yourself. Do you gently come back? Or sometimes do you go, oh, shit, right? I moved away from the breath. Let me bring it back. Let me bring it back. And Pema Chodron talks about this so beautifully. She says, you know, let it be a celebration. Like, yay me. I noticed that I was away from my breath. Because what brought you back? Your awareness brought you back. So you celebrate that moment instead of being aversive to it. And you actually sink into it a little bit more. What does presence feel like? Let me nurture this a little bit. So it's a more of a celebration. And then we begin again, and we do it again. And it might be different every time. You might sit down and be really kind to yourself at one sit, and then another sit, you're just beating up on yourself and trying to have that perfection. So again, to use the metaphor of shedding your clothes, if you will, practice meditation also involves shedding the layers of who you think you are, and really, in this way, becoming more and more yourself, just pure awareness, experiencing change. And again, in a way, inside of Vipassana practice is where we are being asked, metaphorically, of course, to take off our old stale identities. If you can think about it, the outfits that you wear, the identity out, what are your identity outfits? What face do you put on in the mirror, not just your clothes? What identity are you putting on when you wake up in the morning? You can ask yourself that. And through the practice, we learn to keep shedding those ideas of ourselves, taking those off, never actually solidifying into a self. We are constantly evolving. We're always new. And the more and more we practice, the more and more that we can relax into this constant beginning again, this constant change. Dharmavita David Brazen says, Buddhism asks us to go beyond the self. Buddhism asks us to go beyond the self, not to perfect the self. So the idea is that while you're going to feel in many ways naked and exposed, you're also going to feel like a newborn. You're completely new at this. You have no idea what's going to happen, but it's where you start. You take baby steps, and eventually you grow and mature, and then you change again. Okay. So whenever I find myself metaphorically being kind of out in the cold and rain without my blanket, if you will, I practice three simple affirmations that I've shared in here before. The first is a recognition of my suffering. It's a recognition. And I love how Sylvia Borstein describes this. The words she uses are so simple. It's, sweetie, you are in pain. Isn't that beautiful? The reason I love that is it's kind, sweetie. It's being nice to yourself. And it's also a recognition of the pain. It's kind of very tidy. It's right in that moment. Sweetie, are you in pain? The second is gratitude. I actually, again, bow and say thank you for this opportunity to learn and transform and to become something new. You know, instead of being stuck, thank you for the suffering. And then the third on top of that is, may this suffering serve awakening in some way. Instead of resisting it, you open to it, say thank you for the suffering. May the suffering serve awakening. And may I continue to be kind to myself through the suffering. So whenever I can do this, it's always a way for me to really remember and reaffirm what the Buddha called the three characteristics of life, which are suffering, dukkha. There is suffering. It's inevitable. I'm going to experience it. It's okay. It's just life. It's suffering. Impermanence, anicca. Everything, including me, is constantly changing all the time. And no self, anatta, which means that I am not a solid, unchangeable I or self, and I don't need a place to place a label or an identity on myself, especially an identity of someone or somebody who's flawed. Okay. And I always have the opportunity to begin again because each and every moment is always brand new. The teacher Lewis Richard simplified the three characteristics into this really helpful phrasing, which is everything is connected, nothing lasts, and you are not alone. Isn't that great? Like, he sums up the three characteristics of life in a simple phrase. Everything's connected, anatta, no self. Nothing lasts, anicca. And you are not alone, dukkha, suffering, we all suffer. German teacher Bhikkhu and Alyo, who was grateful to study with this April, he's great. Has anybody read this book? No? A couple people? Okay. Yes, awesome. Bhikkhu and Alyo, he's great. He sums up the entire meditation practice in 4 words. You ready? It really, if you don't need to do it, you can all go home after the 4 words, is that it's keep calmly knowing change. So simple. Keep calmly knowing change. So it's keep continually calmly knowing, being aware of change. That's the whole practice. Good night. Namaste. Which means everything's new. It's always new. You know, each moment is completely new. The only thing that we ever have is right now in the present. In the Zen tradition, this is called beginner's mind. You know? And if you notice, if you've spent some time meditating, we spend probably most of our time regretting the past and worrying about the future, right? And guess what? We're not living when we're doing that. If we're in the present or the future, we're dreaming. We're not awake. The practice is about becoming awake. Everybody thinks that that's such a lofty goal, to be awake. But every moment that you're present, you're awake, which is interesting. Think about when you walked in here before, when you were claiming your seat, if you will, and just sitting down and greeting everybody. What is that now? It's a dream, isn't it? It's not real anymore. It's just a memory. It's not there. What are you going to do after the sit tonight? Some of you might be hungry. You have plans for dinner. Do your plans ever turn out exactly the way you think they're going to turn out? Never, right? They're a little slightly different. So that's a dream too. So you might notice how often you spend dreaming your life away and not being awake, when you're worrying about the future or regretting the past and thinking about it. And so the practice really is about being here in each moment. Every moment is new. This moment right now is new. My talk 45 minutes ago started, now it's done, mostly. This moment is new. So, the only moment that is real ever is now. And the only moment we'll ever be experiencing is now. So we really literally are new in every moment. So I think I want to end there tonight and just invite you all to settle for a moment, just to end, just for 1 more minute in silence. And just taking a nice deep breath in. Breath out. And I'd like to invite those of you who would like to just place one hand on the heart and one on the belly. Breathing into the fingers. Really just take a nice deep breath in. Deep breath out. And then again, a new breath, knowing that it's a very new moment, new breath. And an exhale. Maybe a pause at the end of the exhale. And then a new breath arises. So through our practice, we can start noticing beginning again each moment new just by noticing how each breath is brand new. Remembering that. Keep calmly knowing change. Remembering that along with the breath, that you too are brand new in each moment. And just imagine that. Your whole being, new, brand new, beginning again. Nothing has been ruined. There's no such thing as failure. You can always begin again. Finally, just listening to these words from theologian Frederick Buechner, who writes, in the entire history of the universe, let alone your own history, there has never been another day just like today, and there will never be another just like it again. Today is the point to which all your yesterdays have been leading since the hour of your birth. It is the point from which all your tomorrows will proceed until the hour of your death. If you were aware of how precious today is, you could hardly live through it. Unless you are aware of how precious it is, you can hardly be said to be living at all.